For my last handout, you should have this one just one-sided, because I have less text that I want to talk about and more lecture that I'm going to supplement our textual discussion. What I'm going to do today, a little bit different than what my pattern has been done been the last three days, is to walk through the text with you, looking at a few passages, as we've been doing for about half the time. And then the other half of the time, I want to introduce you to two ways of reading the City of God in Book 19. Because as you may or may not be aware, Book 19 is the locus classicus for fierce modern disputes about how to read Augustine. And so in the second half, I'm going to turn to our own version of originalism and textualist arguments about how to read Augustine. And that will be basically a dispute between medieval and modern readings of Augustine. Does the Augustine that we have read so far fit better with modern liberal order, the sort of philosophical operating system since the 18th century, or does it fit better with, say, medieval Christendom? And that's what we'll discuss in the second half, is what's the most plausible reading of Augustine, and does it matter? Does it matter? So that's how we're going to divide up our time, just a little bit differently, so be patient with this, a new approach. But I think it's good to get a kind of common set of texts. The one trick of getting this many people to sit down around a text and read is that you have to pick things out. And I'm picking out a few things for you, and you might see other things in Book 19 that you want to put your finger on, and feel free to do that at any point. But our first half hour here, I want to give to just looking at the text together. I want to point out just one text that's prior to Book 19. There's quite a few important things in Book 16, 17, and 18. These are part of the historical development of the two cities, and 19, you'll remember, is about the destined ends of the two cities. So this is, when we're into 19, we're thinking teleological about how things are ordered to what ends, okay? But in 18, at the end of 18, we're still in this kind of question of how are the two cities going to be related? And there's this very interesting passage at the end of 18. After a long discussion of those who think Christian persecution has come to an end permanently. Some Christians thought, I mean, you can kind of sympathize, right? Several centuries of persecution and then Constantinian peace, and this sense that, yeah, maybe aunt and uncle will never have to be eaten by lions again. And so there were some Christians who argued that the new kind of arrangements means that Christians will never be persecuted again. And Augustine, of course, says this is absurd. Right, that the Christians will be persecuted in every age. The Lord told us this himself. If they hated me, they're going to hate you. And you're going to suffer persecution. But this also won't always be the permanent thing, right? It's never always going to be persecution or some permanent peace in which you're not persecuted. And so Augustine, at the end of this section of 15 through 18, where he's thinking about the vicissitudes of history and how things are going to change, he wants the reader to think about this, that the persecution's not the end. That persecution hasn't come to an end, but that persecution always has a purpose to test the faithful and to punish the wicked. And so he says here at the end of 18, the gospel was proclaimed throughout the whole world amid terrible persecutions and the manifold tortures and deaths of martyrs. And God bore witness by signs and manifestations and varied acts of power, so that the power of the Holy Spirit, so that the people of the Gentiles might reverence with Christian love the blood of the martyrs. So that the blood of the martyrs might be, in a sense, evidence of God's action in the world, right? And that that's what people would venerate. When he has a whole thing about how we worship at the shrine of our altars, but they're not gods, right? But they manifest for us the presence of God in the world. God made the martyr. Now, it might look to you like the king made the martyr, or that Caesar made the martyr. But Augustine says, no, no, no. God makes the martyr. The martyr is God's action in the world, right? The king is an instrumental cause. So what does this do in the world? And he says, well, this helps Christians love the martyrs and love God's action in the martyr. It also helps kings. What's the effect? The very kings who by whose laws the church was being devastated might for their salvation become subject to the name which they had ruthlessly tried to remove from the earth and might begin to persecute false gods. Does this sound like anybody in recent Roman history for Augustine?
Theodosius
or Constantine, right? Who he talks about and praises both Constantine and Theodosius in Book 5, precisely because they do this. They actually see, this is a grave injustice. They see the God who is acting in the martyr, and they repent, right? And they, instead of persecuting the Christians, now begin to stamp out false religio. So right at the end there of Book 18, he thinks very dynamically about how the persecution actually can be, shall we say, the seed of the church, but also could be fructifying for the, shall we say, secular order or temporal rule, right? That it would be fructifying for both. It's fructifying for the church, because it elevates Christian worship to recognize that God's acting in the martyr. Even when the Christian's being persecuted, the martyr is trusting in God's providence to be his or her defender. If you're getting roasted on the pit, it helps to think that God's going to, you know, bring you to glory. But it also is going to help the king, to turn the king. So that there's this sense at the end of 18 that even when things slide down into a persecutorial state for the Christian, at the nadir of that scale, God's action can turn the whole thing to move back up the scale. Right? This is, I think, a very important way for Augustine to remind the Christians that the persecution is something that might just end up being cyclical that you should accept, right? In fact, it will just be cyclical and you should accept it. But that the persecution itself is a sign of hope, not only for the church, but for the world. This is a complex way of thinking about the persecution, because you're neither thinking of the church as some embattled minority that's always going to be dying, right? It's going to be sometimes dying, but when it is dying in the Colosseum or wherever, that's actually going to affect a change in society. Well, that's the hope, that it would affect a change in the society, and that would change the tenor of things so that maybe you would have the peace of the city that would then the church would depend on. The church would use the peace of the city. That's what we'll get into in Book 19. So Book 19 does a lot of different things, and most of the interpretive dispute is around like two chapters, chapters 23 and 24. So we're going to get to chapters 23 and 24 very briefly here. That's the argument with Cicero that he's promised to bring to fulfillment, and he brings it to fulfillment in two short chapters. But a few things that are in back of that in chapters 13, 16, 17, and 21, just to set up the trajectory that Augustine is looking at here. A great deal of the framework for the discussion in 19 is set up around chapter 13, in which Augustine, you'll remember, kind of charts out the tranquility of order in the soul, in the family, the domestic tranquility of order, the tranquility of order in the body, too. Tranquility of order in the soul. The lower things should be subject to the higher things, right? The lower good subject to the higher good, all throughout, at every level. And so there's a kind of, we've been talking about natural hierarchy. There is a kind of natural hierarchy that Augustine recognizes, that this is, I think you said, the city of God is the reality. Here, this is the hierarchy that's the reality of the tranquility of order that we should understand. That is the thing. The peace of the whole universe is the tranquility of order. The order, and order is the arrangement of things equal and unequal. That's his way of saying hierarchy. And in a pattern which assigns to each its proper position. And if we think of the things that Father Aquinas has been talking about, we can think of precisely how we might think of particular and common goods as having their proper position. And now, he doesn't have any personalists or Marxists to fight against. But it's interesting. But it's interesting that he doesn't begin with the person per se. He thinks of the house. The house is kind of the real fundamental unit. Now, a man's house ought to be the beginning. We start from the house. That's really interesting, right? That's where we begin. We think of, we count parishes in terms of families. We think about the family as the cell of society. Here you have that kind of discourse here in Augustine too. The household is the beginning and a small part of component part of the city. And every beginning is directed to some end of its own kind, and every component part contributes to the completeness of the whole. So we have that part whole discussion of how things relate and are ordered to one another in a dynamic ordering of the good. Okay, the implication is quite apparent, Augustine says. What's the implication? That domestic peace contributes to the peace of the city. That these are intimately related. The good of the family, the common good of the family, is intimately related to the common good of the city. And domestic peace makes a contribution to that. And presumably he'd also say that the peace of the city makes a contribution to the family. But here he says it contributes to the ordered harmony concerning authority and obedience obtaining among the citizens. Now, it's interesting that Augustine doesn't say state here. You know, you might say state, just say, oh, political authority or state. But he thinks of the state in terms of something, what we would call state. He wants to speak usually about things like the relations obtaining between citizens. And that goes with the Ciceronian definition, right, better than some abstract concept of state that we might more freely employ as modern post-18th century liberals. Yes. So I'll hand it over. No. Okay. Feel free to raise your hand and say, hang on. Okay. The heavenly city knows only one God as the object of worship. The argument of Book 10 is continually punctuates what Augustine wants to say in books 11 through 22. The book 10 argument is constantly pulsing in you, and I just highlight one sentence here so that you can see. It remains the thing which pulses throughout his
demonstrations here. The heavenly city knows only one God as the object of worship and decrees with faithful devotion that he only is to be served with that service which the Greeks call latria, which is due to God alone. That's going to be central to what he says in chapter 23. Now we return to thinking about the heavenly city in her pilgrimage here on use, making use of the earthly peace. While this heavenly city is on pilgrimage in this world, thinking of the Catholic Church as the kind of umbrella at the top of a scale, we can say Civitas Dei is the reality, right? And at the top of that scale is the church on pilgrimage. While this heavenly city is on pilgrimage in this world, she calls out citizens from all nations. That is to say, the church is like a hydraulic body, right, which is pulling up from every nation into herself. If you go over to the basilica, what do you find in the side altars and shrines? Marian apparitions to each of the nations, right? This is a national shrine, a shrine. If you go over there, you see a shrine in which the nations are prayed for, in which God is present to the nations. And here, this is also Augustine's view, is that the church is present to the nations and is pulling the fugitives out and converting them to the city of God. How Augustine begins and closes the argument of the first book, right, that we want to bring out, turn fugitives into pilgrims. So here we're calling out in a hydraulic way, pulling up into reality all those nations, collecting a society of aliens speaking all languages. She takes no account of any difference in customs, laws, and institutions by which earthly peace is achieved and preserved. Not that she annuls or abolishes any of those. Grace does not destroy nature, but perfects and elevates it, is a good Thomistic axiom. Here, Augustine upholds that. She doesn't annul or abolish any of those. Rather, she maintains them and follows them, provided that there's no hindrance presented to the religion which teaches that the one supreme and true God is to be worshipped. Thus, even the heavenly city in her pilgrimage here on earth makes use of the earthly peace and defends and seeks the compromise between human wills. Does that surprise you? The uncompromising Augustine? It's quite compromising. Maybe surprises us? No. That Augustine pays attention to the fact that there's going to be conflicts, that there's going to be the need for compromises, that this is going to need to be obtained between citizens, and that the church will be present in that, in those conflicts and dynamic battles between human wills, which require prudential compromises. As long as the compromises, there's a kind of limit, right? As long as the compromises don't compromise the church, right? A whole set of prudential arrangements might be entertained so long as the freedom of the church, the goods, the common good of the church is not harmed. This church seeks the compromise between human wills in respect to the provisions relevant to the moral nature of man so far as may be permitted without detriment to true religion and piety. You think about the church's place in the world in terms of diplomacy. The church is active in the world. The Vatican diplomatic corps is one of the most impressive diplomatic corps in the world, even though it's very, very tiny. It has an
outsized influence in the world. And I think Augustine would recognize that as something which is the rightful place for the church in the world. Now we're to the Ciceronian argument. What do we do with Cicero? He promised us, kept making us wait and wait and wait. But now, finally, 17 books later, I promised that I would show that there never was a Roman Commonwealth answering to the definitions advanced by Scipio in Cicero's On the Republic. For Scipio defined a people as a multitude united in association by a common sense of right and a community of interest. Remember. He explains in the discussion what he means by a common sense of right, showing that a state, here we do use the language of statu, cannot be maintained without justice. And where there is no true justice, there can be no right. Therefore, where there is no true justice, there can be no association of men united by a common sense of right. And therefore, no people answering to the definition. If there is no people, then there is no common weal or common good of the people, but some kind of mob. The irresistible conclusion is that where there is no justice, there is no commonwealth, since justice is that virtue which assigns to everyone his due. It has the tranquility of order at its proper level. It has the tranquility of order at its proper level. If it lacks that tranquility of order, he says it can't be, has disruptions in it, right? There's things which are disordered in it, and therefore if there's things which are disordered in it, it doesn't have the tranquility of order, which true justice requires to render each its due. So that irresistible conclusion is that without true justice, there is no commonwealth. What kind of justice is it, he says, that takes a man away from the true God? This tells us something important about what he thinks true justice is. True justice is precisely in where a polity or a people or a soul or a household, right, is brought into communion with the one who achieves justice, Christ himself. So, when we look at the commonwealth and it doesn't render true justice, it doesn't render what's due to God, when Rome subjects its people to unclean demons, as he says, we can surely agree with Cicero that this is not a commonwealth on the strict definition. This does not assign each his due. And so he's sided with the very pessimistic side of Cicero. Cicero's not always so pessimistic, but here he's pessimistic, and he sides with this pessimistic Cicero that Rome was ceased to be a commonwealth. It follows that justice is found where God, and here we're into the two chapters which are most disputed, chapter 23 and 24. It follows that justice is found where God, the one supreme God, rules an obedient city according to his grace. Right? Top of the scale. This is where the proper exchanges of authority and obedience go on. Things are properly ordered in an obedient city which lives according to his grace. Now, this does not say that there are not sinners in the church. It says that they are ordered in such a way that they can be reconciled to authority, and they have the opportunity to be reconciled. And this produces a tranquility of order in the soul that is good, accords with reality. Where in consequence the soul rules the body and all men who belong to this city and obey God, and reason faithfully rules the vices in a lawful system.
so that the association or people of righteous men lives on the same basis of faith. There's a common creed that is active in love, the love with which a man loves God as God ought to be loved and loves his neighbor as himself. But where this justice does not exist, there is no commonwealth. In this sense, he has hyper-eminentialized Cicero's definition of commonwealth into the heavenly realm, right? It's a super-eminentializing of the Ciceronian definition. This is something which goes up here, and sometime, I'm not going to hold off on the interpretive, but you can imagine that for some that throwing it up into heaven means it's never here on earth. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll save that as for our interpretive dispute. That is, on earth you only ever have imperfect justice, and we don't have any access to that. And so we might as well just put that out of our minds. Okay, 24 gives us his famous second definition. A second definition is required. Why? Why do we require? Why does Augustine think there's a need for a second definition? What do you think?
To account for like the scalar cities that we had discussed before, and to some extent we can talk about Rome as approximating the city of God, or Jerusalem, or
the... You'd have both cities evident in an empirical city, and so you'd want any empirical city to move up the scale towards the reality and not down the scale towards what's a privation of it. Yes.
And it seems to me that as we discussed yesterday, at some points both cities are sort of indistinguishable from one another, where they're really like...
Well, the only time he really says they're indistinguishable is prior to the flood. And then it's plucking out the eight. But generally, he thinks that they can be distinguished according to characteristics.
Or at least that there are moments in history where they are very close, like closer to one another. And there are moments in history where they're farther away from one another.
Yeah.
It seems to me that speaking about justice, like in the first definition, is sort of very idealistic, but like not... I don't know if idealistic is the right word, but a second definition would be useful for the other.
Second definition would be useful because if we think that this first definition is never going to be obtained in any republic or monarchy or aristocratic polity, then we need some other concept of how the political community is going.
I'm usually thinking about the moments of persecution, you know, where he mentions from, like, you know, it will return, you know,
yeah.
It will go down and then it will rise up again. But during these moments of persecution, it seems that you need something more.
Yeah.
So an alternative.
Once you start thinking about this metaphysical scale, it's a little easier to understand how that would be necessary for Augustine, right? Now you need to think about, well, we still are political animals and we still need political communities and we need a way of thinking about that, right? That first definition of the commonwealth, which redounds to the city of God on pilgrimage, also is needed. We need to have that, in a sense, to judge where we are on the scale. And that's precisely what he gives us in this realist account of a realist definition of the republic, of a commonwealth. If, on the other hand, another definition for this commonwealth is found, for example, if one should say, a people is the association of a multitude of rational beings united by a common agreement about the objects of love. So let's break that down, right? We have a multitude of rational beings. We've got an anthropology in place that certainly Cicero can agree with, right? That we're rational by nature, and that whenever we have a multitude of rational beings, we can use our reason to determine our agreements that are in accord with law. Right. We have a common agreement on the what? Common objects of love. What are common objects of love?
Values. Goals.
Yeah, somehow I don't think he would have said values and goals, but I know what you mean. Common objects of love for him, I think, would be something like particular and common good. Things that we are actually objects of love. Maybe I say I love Velveeta cheese, but that's a very, and maybe it was more like when I was 7, but that's a very low object of love. Objects of love are goods which we either use or misuse, right? And so they're these objects of love that we can go up a scale or down the scale. Peace is better than Velveeta cheese, right? So that's a higher good. Velveeta cheese is the very low good. So objects of love might be helpfully thought about in terms of goods, objects that we have a desire for, that we desire, even naturally desire.
Do you think he could have in mind, you know, he talked about glory.
So you could have disordered desires,
yeah.
Right? So objects of love is a very open concept, right? Because it could be both particular and common goods, but it could also be misapprehensions of what those are or a misuse of those goods, right? Disordering your love. So this remember, sometimes he thinks of justice as just right order, and sometimes he thinks of this tranquility of order in terms of the right ordering of our love. So he has both the objective and the subjective dimension.
Could
yes?
Could objects be both like particular to the polity and also more generic, like peace as opposed to like, you know, the specific landscape? You know?
Temporal and eternal for him, right? And then remember the importance of uniting the temporal and the eternal, not detaching them. So that the temporal goods would be under display under one aspect, and eternal peace, temporal peace obviously is a temporal good, and eternal peace, the higher good. Okay, so common objects of love. Then it follows that there is no absurdity in applying to it the title of a people. Now notice how open this definition is, right? This could go very high or very low. Right, the common objects of love might be Velveeta cheese. That's the only thing that we can agree on. That's our common object of love. We're the nation of cheese. And we all agree that Velveeta cheese is good, and that's the main thing that binds us together. Well, that puts us really... You might Velveeta cheese is a good, so it puts you somewhere on the scale where you're still in the good realm. But what if it's we all love pornography? That's what we all agree on, is that pornography is a good and should be defended and we have a right to it. Where does that put us on the scale? Pretty low, right? Right, so the beauty of the second definition is it admits of a lot of degrees, right? What I call the scalar definition of a commonwealth admits of enormous complexity, right? And at the end of City of God 19 and at the beginning of 20, his theme is judgment. How do we make good human judgments is a theme that is pulsates throughout 19 about the ends, about human ends. And in 20, book 20, he's going to turn to how does God make judgments? Right. Well, look what these two definitions help us to do. It helps us to make judgments about the world. We have a transcendent, eternal standard for the highest common good, the commonwealth, which is united to God and unites a love of God, of neighbor, and true justice through the sacrifice of Christ. And then that transcendent standard
enables us to see where the objects of love are in any given city or house or soul, right? Now we have a better standard than what Cicero gave us. Cicero gave us a kind of unrealistic standard, right? Not the most useful standard. So now Augustine, the great rhetor, who was the great imperial rhetor at Milan, is now the one who has exceeded Cicero because he's given a much more realistic standard. He's taken the Ciceronian standard and he's given it its proper terminus. He's located it properly at its proper level. And that becomes a standard for judgment of where the common objects of love are people. And that actually makes the church an expert in humanity, as John Paul says, right? John Paul the Great. The church is now an expert in society, now an expert in polities, now can actually judge rightly where any polity is and might be persecuted. Right? If the church on pilgrimage is living amidst a Babylonian peace down here in which porn is the major common good, is the central common good, and a slippage a little bit more, the church's teaching against porn suddenly turns persecutorial, right? The church sees clearly the culture that it's in, sees clearly the city that it's in, and maybe has to shed blood for it. But if it sheds blood for it, if we go back to the end of book 18, that is a sign of hope, that we can move back up. People can say, yeah, maybe porn is not a good common object of love. Maybe that doesn't really unite us properly. Maybe that doesn't really bring us to a proper ordering, a right ordering. So the better the objects of this agreement, then, we get the definition of what moves you up and down. The better the objects of the common agreement. Velveeta cheese is better than porn, so that moves you a little bit up the scale. The better the objects of this agreement, the better the people. The worse the objects of love, the worse the people. By this definition of ours, well, then the Roman people is a people and its estate is indubitably a commonwealth. Right? Now Augustine can say, hey, Cicero didn't even tell you you were a commonwealth. I'm telling you you're a commonwealth, but it's one thing to say you're a commonwealth. It's another thing to say, what kind of commonwealth are you? And so he's giving a much more useful definition, a definition which admits of degrees and enables critical thinking about the order of households, cities, societies, political communities. Yes?
For this second definition, how much is he intending it to apply only to political entities, like we would say them, or would he call commonwealth a university or
yeah.
a company or a monastic community, or like
yeah.
there's lots of different communities that
it's
this
a great
could apply
question.
To that aren't strictly
guilds,
political.
Does it apply to guilds, trade
would he
unions?
Call those, or does he mean it in a strict political?
I think the occasion is clearly in the Ciceronian sense, but his definition, I think, admits of thinking about lower common goods than the political community, the trade union, or the university. Universities are very much like cities, very political. So as the great progressive Woodrow Wilson was asked why he was leaving the governorship of New Jersey to become president of Princeton University, so I just had to get out of politics. universities are very political, so certainly the university, the common objects of love of a university would be... But you're right. He's mainly thinking in the Ciceronian frame of a political community, but very applicable. And certainly, based on what he says earlier, applicable to the family, too. What are the common objects of love of this family? If the common objects of love of the family are low, how could we elevate them? Would be a way to think about it. Yes?
Sorry, I was just wondering, can the goods or the... Sorry, the objects of love, can they be kind of internally self... Or can they be sort of contradictory of the whole concept of the Commonwealth in the first place. Like, let's say if the society was based on there's a limited amount of money, but the society is basically based on a consensus that of greed, as in, it just doesn't really make logical
sense. We love money, we don't have money.
Well, insofar as I have money, you don't, so it doesn't really make sense for us to come together. It doesn't make, like, economic sense for us to be a people associated by this common interest, but maybe it does on a, like, psychological or social sense. So I'm just wondering whether that could be...
Well, I mean, I think you would probably not hesitate to say that if the common object of love was money, that would be maybe above porn, but maybe below Velveeta cheese. that's a pretty low object of love. That's how his analysis works. I don't think this analysis helps you to think about where would you place goods on a metaphysical scale. And so I don't think money would go very high on this scale. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, well, I was just wondering if...
I'm confused about the contradiction.
Well, some goods, like that good, actually your best bet, and then people should really just split up and not be a commonwealth, because they're actually against each other.
Mm.
It's just like observing societies,
okay,
where they actually, the things that they worship are actually,
okay,
things that are so individualistic that they're anti-society, if that makes sense.
Okay, so what I would say is this is something like a normative description, so that it helps you to see where you are. It doesn't actually tell you what you should do, except for you better find better common goods, because that's not going to actually hold you together. That's going to lead to fresh misery. And sometimes you will just be led to fresh misery. He's a realist, right? Sometimes the political community is just going to be bad. And what do you do in that case in which people love these lowest goods and misuse the lowest goods to such an extent that they actually are building a city on pride which hates God, which is alienated from God? What do you do at that bottom of the scale in which they hate the Christian, they hate God, they hate Jesus Christ? Offer prayers. This is how he concludes this argument, that at the bottom of the scale, the church is still there, offering the witness, praying for the city. Even when the head is being put into the lion's mouth, even thrown onto the barbecue pit, you're praying for the city. You're praying for Babylon, because her peace is your peace, because you're not separated from her. You're with her in her ravaging, diabolical envy. You're with her, and you pray for the city. You, in a sense, depend on her. You can't be utterly separated from her. You're called out. You're not of her, but you're with her. And you pray for the city. You pray for the city when we're down low, and when you pray for the city when you're up high. Okay. Now, I have baked in an interpretation to this presentation of the city of God, and so I want to give you some taste of another way of reading the city of God, and then come back to what I think is the correct way to read it. I've painted this as a medieval modern dispute, but I'm not going to really give you much in the way of medieval interpretation, except to say that I think the reading that we've just performed here together is one that fits better with how Europe is formed than with how post-Enlightenment modern liberal orders are formed. So, but I want to give you one of the most important theorists, arguably the most important Augustinian theorist, named Robert Marcus. He is a friend of liberalism, a former Dominican, I'm afraid. He was a former Dominican. I don't know how long he went. Not long. sorry, fallen away. but he's fallen away. And Robert Marcus is a very good scholar. He's passed now, but died in 2010, 1924 to 2010. A very, very good scholar, very good reader of Augustine in many, many ways. I agree with a lot of things he says in other parts, but on this point, I don't agree with him. He writes, in his defense, he writes his interpretation of Augustine following the council, Second Vatican Council, which was very optimistic about the world, very optimistic about political liberalism in the wake of the wars, hoping very optimistically that liberalism and openness to the world was something that was essential and that we needed to overcome a kind of fortress mentality in which the church was somehow against liberalism, the church was somehow against modernity. And so Marcus is very much a part of that. Let's overcome the fortress mentality. Let's get out into the world and be we'll be in the world, not of the world, but when we're in the world, we'll be cheering for it, cheering for openness to the world. For Marcus, Augustine's central insight is not about how to order commonwealths to the summum bonum, but rather his central political insight is that commonwealths are decidedly not the city of God, but also decidedly not the city of man. That is, the secular is something that is neither of the two cities. It's a kind of in-between space. So secular orders must be neutral with respect to questions of religio. With respect to the church as the city of God on pilgrimage, he has no question. That's something to be separated off. And of course, when we look at the secular city, it's a kind of commingling of two cities. And so we must think of the secular as something neutral, precisely because we can't distinguish the two cities. An amalgam of the two cities in which we should think about the basic structures of politics as needing to be neutral with respect to any higher goods, the summum bonum. They must be neutral. Augustine's insight was really, for Marcus, that state neutrality was better for the Republic, better for a commonwealth, because it desacralized it. For Marcus, Augustine's great contribution to the West is that he desacralized politics. Right? Now politics is, now we can see politics is totally separated from the sacred, because he's thrown up the sacred into the heavenly, and that's something apart from the world. And so politics has now been desacralized. In Marcus's early work, inspired by the Second Vatican Council, he has this interpretation of Augustine as a thinker who not only is not a traditionalist enemy of liberalism, but its greatest friend. That liberalism itself not only is Christian, but is Augustinian. That liberalism is itself the inspired by Augustine's own teaching. And so liberalism is a proper fruition of the Augustinian West. This is because he thinks Augustine has given us a vision of the state as neither city of God nor city of man, but rather as something like a temporal process. That Augustine's helped us to think about the secular as a time, as a seculum, as a temporal age in which the cities are commingled to an indistinguishable degree. Speaking of a Christian state, according to Marcus, would have seemed like a category mistake to Augustine. Thinking of an ordering of authority and obedience between citizens, which somehow recognized true religion, would, for Marcus, be a category mistake. This would be a medieval anachronism to impose upon Augustine that's not true to Augustine. Never mind that Augustine praises Constantine for recognizing Christian religion. Never mind that Augustine effusively praises Theodosius for not only establishing Christianity as the true religion, as the religion of empire, but also for bashing all the shrines to the false gods. Marcus sees all of these kinds of claims on Augustine as medieval encroachments on what the text actually says, right? These are developments of Augustine which are illegitimate, right? So maybe Marcus is like Luther, who is going back to the to Glibney. Speaking of a Christian state, for Augustine, Marcus thinks would be a category mistake in which we do something like immanentize the eschaton, right? We would be making an error, which might lead us to sort of Marxist progressive ideas of history. So, because Rome must be placed as a commingling between two cities, separable only at the end of time, Marcus concludes that Rome must be theologically neutral. He takes pains to say that the seculum is not some third thing, a tertium quid in the Augustinian technical term, but that we should nevertheless view political action and the state fitting into this, quote, area of indeterminacy between two cities. Sort of agnostic about the place of the state between two cities. Now, to me, that sounds like the tertium quid that he says it isn't. A tertium quid of secular or liberal neutrality. Marcus's state sounds strangely similar to John Rawls. In Christianity and the Secular, Marcus argues that Augustine's neutral seculum was essentially lost as early medieval bishops trained in monasteries, and as the quest for perfection divided everything into good and... How long do I get? Am I doing okay on time? Do I go to 10:30?
Yes.
Okay, so I'll try to talk fast so you can talk. Marcus argues that Augustine's neutral seculum essentially was lost as early medieval bishops were trained in monasteries, and as the quest for Christian perfection was dividing everything into good and evil, the medievals had somehow lost sight of Augustine's profound insight that in this present life we will only know imperfection. As if Charlemagne was convinced that he could build Christendom to exact heavenly specifications. Since Augustine's medieval inheritors had no room for a middle ground, so Marcus argues, they erred in their reading of him. On Marcus's account, Christendom was, in fact, not Augustinian. It was a departure from Augustine, a mistake. And at least in certain respects, liberal orders have actually recovered the lost Augustinian wisdom. What Augustine's medieval inheritors failed to understand, Marcus argues, is the state is a referee, allowing its citizens to pursue their ends in as unencumbered a way as possible. Augustine's, quote, account of the origins of political authority brings into play what Sir Isaiah Berlin has called the negative concept of freedom, the sense according to which any coercion implies a diminution of liberty. Never mind that Augustine uses the state to put down the Donatist rebellion. Marcus's argument here makes especially clear that the liberal tendencies in his thought drive his interpretation of Augustine. The stakes for how one understands government are high. For, quote, what is at stake between the two conceptions of political authority in the end, Marcus says, is the meaning of freedom. Marcus's liberal understanding of freedom, shorn from metaphysical and theological arguments about the human telos and the purpose of freedom, coheres with his value-neutral state, claiming no task for the state beyond allowing its citizens freedom from any external claims, essentially libertarian.
Marcus agrees with Augustine that human beings are by nature social, but their socialness does not require politics except by dint of sin. In this way, he agrees with Protestant interpretations of Augustine that claim that the government exists only as a result of sin and not as a metaphysical need of human nature as such. Marcus thus denies, on the basis of his reading of Augustine, any ontological necessity to the state, just as he denies its sacrality. The state has a certain pragmatic temporal necessity, but nothing more. When Marcus gets to Augustine's famous distinctions between our two definitions of commonwealth, what does he do? Well, one is defined absolutely in terms of supreme justice. He recognizes that. And he sees that the first definition is something reserved for heaven, which is true in its way, if incomplete. The other defined, he recognizes as common objects of love. The second definition for Marcus means something like thinking of the state as a group of people who love things in common, and that's all we need to say. That's what he takes away from Augustine's second definition. That is, the second definition is simply neutral. The second definition of commonwealth is just a neutral descriptive term for saying people who love things in common. Anybody who loves things in common is a commonwealth. And therefore, the second definition is entirely neutral, positivistic. These are his terms. The second definition is neutral and positivistic. That is, it's looking at commonwealth as having their own integrity quite apart from any higher ends, and even detached from them. As Gregory Lee has correctly noted, Marcus's reading runs against the stated aim of Book 19 to contrast the earthly and heavenly cities on the summum bonum, what is their relation to the highest good, and not as a contrast between the modern dyad of church and state. And this is something that's come out in recent literature, the way in which our very dyad of church and state is anachronistic projection onto Augustine. The church and state being a pair that you never see in Augustine. He never talks about the relation between church and state as such. Marcus refuses to refer earthly commonwealths to the highest good. Why? After Augustine spent so much time, right, insisting about how the lower should be related to the higher, why can Marcus read Augustine differently? It is the thrust of Marcus's whole, it is the thrust of Augustine's whole argument to convince skeptical Romans that Christianity has not only not been bad for the empire, but that it is both temporal and eternal hope for it. Marcus's reading of Augustine's account of the state, in my view, is deeply flawed, but it is understandable and even typical of most Christian defenses of liberalism today. The Augustine of letter 138, if you remember, that's the letter that I put on the first handout that you received, the end of the first handout. If you have access to it, you can read it again. The Augustine of letter 138 argued that Christian faith allows the Christian to be a better Roman citizen. And thus, Christianity elevates the metaphysical understanding and the moral condition of any given commonwealth. This Augustine of letter 138 is nowhere to be found in Marcus. Marcus constructs a new secular-friendly Augustine. He mistakes Augustine's second definition of commonwealth as his only definition in order to detach res publica from religio, which is to say, secular through and through in a manner that excludes the sacred, to quote him.
He has been roundly criticized for this, and in his late work, Marcus admits that in doing so he, or this is before he had passed away, came perilously close to making Augustine the precursor of modern secular liberalism. So the late Marcus admits, yeah, maybe I've gone a little too far here. Sort of like how John Rawls. Maybe I went a little too far with religion, but excluding religion. In contrast to modern liberalism and his own tendency to read an atomistic pluralism into Augustine, Marcus states Augustine could never conceive a fully human life except in a social context. In this respect, his position is mutatis mutandi, akin to that of modern critics of liberal individualism, unquote. And in contrast to his arguments that the res publica is utterly value neutral, the late Marcus concedes that a value neutral society is impossible and against the grain of Augustine. This is his late life concession. He unravels many of his most basic claims about a liberal Augustinianism. Nevertheless, the Marcus reading remains powerful and dominant. And one can see, just reading the text, how one might selectively find that reading plausible. Okay. There's a lot more for me to say, and I'm running out of time, and I want to hear from you. So I'm going to stop talking. You've heard an alternative interpretation from my own. I think I won't review the ground that we've covered, but if we look at the trajectory of books 1 and books 2 and 5 and the arguments there, the Mirror of Princes, it does seem that Augustine thinks differently than Marcus about these things. And so I'm curious to know your own thoughts and your own reading of book 19. Yes?
Can I just ask a clarifying question?
Yes.
So he is saying that we have government mostly because of the fall. Without that state of nature, pre-fall, there would have been a need for that. But yet, in the context of government, it needs to be religiously neutral because man...
Marcus.
Yes. Can find their own way, in a sense. So it's kind of, we need this for...
So the state needs to be neutral with regards to metaphysical and theological truths.
Okay.
Because those are things that we simply can only really know these things in the church. Those things are reserved for that city which is in the world but not of the world. And so this is where all the sacrality is, and this scale here doesn't have sacrality. We shouldn't think of there's a kind of way in which he can think of himself as a kind of Niebuhrian realist or something, right? That I'm looking at the state realistically, that the state's never... We actually want to deny any sacrality to the state because that's going to be the best thing for the state, to keep it separate from the church. And so... And there might be a certain kind of... in the background of his misuse of Thomas, a kind of total separation of nature and grace that he's aiming at here. And so that nature is something that has its own integrity and it's positivistic and it doesn't need to be related to anything higher.
Is he just concerned that there would be like a forced conversion, there would be like a lack of authenticity amongst people if there was a religiosity coming from the state? Is that kind of playing out?
No, I think he wants to fit in.
Okay.
Like all Catholics, he wants to fit in. He wants... There's a wonderful essay you're going to hear tonight from Rusty Reno, but there's a wonderful essay that Rusty wrote called, I think it's called Ronard's Restorationism. But he has a discussion there about how Ronner the Restorationist, I think it's called. Do you know this essay, Andrew?
What's that?
Do you know this essay, Ronner the Restorationist? His treatment there of Ronner is that Ronner's really old school medieval.
that Rahner's actually, he wants a accommodation with liberalism, because that's gonna be like a medieval harmony between church and society. I think that's Marcus too. Marcus wants a medieval harmony between church and society, and actually the harmony is going to work best if we desacralize the society, right, and keep it on positivist terms and not actually related to anything. And the church is a stranger in this world after all, right?
So then the cities wouldn't mix in his mind.
Well, they are so mixed in his mind, right? They're so profoundly mixed that we can't distinguish between them.
And so we ought not to.
We ought not to. And that the only distinguishment would be, the only distinguishing mark would be that the church is in the world, that that's where we can see the city of God, and everything else is too confusing, too much amalgam.
Thank you.
Yes.
So what I find the most sort of plausible or compelling in his account is this idea of the desacralization of he's saying not the city of man, but the secular order. A couple points. One, I don't know that that has to mean completely neutral. I don't know that to desacralizing the pod. So, but I think, especially in chapter 17 of book 19, you see Augustine using this language of there does seem to be a distinction between things related to the immortal life,
yeah,
and things related to the mortal life. And he used this language of while the members of the city of God are on pilgrimage, they make use,
yeah,
of, you know, it's kind of, and,
yeah,
and even to your point, they, in that letter you shared, 138, they leaven the polity or something, or
right.
So they're really good citizens in that polity, but
they're the hydraulic force. Right?
Mm.
They're the ones who have the purifying principle, remember, in Augustine?
Mm.
They're the ones who have the purifying principle, and so they themselves are the leaven. They themselves are like a purifying principle. Right? That's, I think the text supports that very strongly. Right? We ourselves are his sacrifice. We ourselves are the purifying principle, and we're the ones who elevate societies, households.
Right.
Cities.
But do you see that as inconsistent with still a distinction, a desacralization of the secular order?
I see. You could say it reorients what the sacred is for a polity, right? So that a pagan polity would need to be, if it's ordered around, if its lower goods are being united to so-called higher goods, and those higher goods turn out to be diamonds, right, then actually that ordering needs to be resacralized. It's already sacralized. So if you think about modern liberal order, as Professor Rumel has done in terms of liturgy, right, you already have something like the fiction. I mean, even Marcus himself admits that in the end he admits that it's not really neutral,
mm-hmm,
and so it already is sacral. And so I think Augustine's point is really not, is that you can never get away from the sacrality. It's what kind of sacrality you have.
I was just cheering the wall.
Oh, okay. but I think in that sense, I think Professor Vermeule is a much better inheritor of Augustine than Professor Marcus. Yes. Sorry, I should go to this side next, I promise.
What if a common object of love, by its very definition, divides the city? Will Augustine still call it a commonwealth? You know, I'm thinking of the city of thieves where injustice is the common object of love. And I'm thinking it related to, let's say, capitalism, for example.
Sure.
It's different from love of money, right?
Yeah.
You can love money and conquer other cities, but if the very thing you love is the concrete
on your own fellow people. So, what I think about this, I'll just say one thing about this, is that I think the Privatio Boni argument is central for understanding how he would answer that question. Is that when that happens, it is all privation. And on the metaphysical scale, that is, what's the opposite of hydraulic?
It's something that is going to disintegrate. It's going to be entropic, right? It's going to lead to disintegration. It's not a sustainable concrete. And you'll see the increase of fresh misery, conflicts, wars, and it will go into that downhill rush into more poison. It's going to go down into whatever the Platonists say, non-being three, the non-being categories. Yes, here.
Question. Okay, I don't know if I'm misinterpreting this, but if we're trying to be kind of sympathetic to Marx's reading, and he says speaking of the Christian state would seem like a category mistake to Augustine.
Yes.
Could we maybe say that, like...
Wait, thinking about what is a category mistake?
Speaking of Christian state.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
No, that is straight to Marcus.
Yes.
Speaking of Christian state would be a category
mistake. Category
mistake,
right. Would we maybe want to affirm, though, that, like, Augustine could conceive of a state that's organized around, like, the exercise of Christianity, the pursuit of virtue, but that I think maybe what Marcus is trying to get at is that, like, Augustine also wants to say at the same time that, like, for example, like, the victory of that state over another state isn't necessarily the victory of the city of God. The victory
Absolutely.
Of the city of God is Christ over sin.
Absolutely.
And that I think maybe that's the kind of confusion that he's worried about.
I think so. I think, he's worried about the way in which the church might become overly identified with a particular political community. And I think that's a legitimate worry to have. But only if you are really trying to think that you're drawing down the city of God into some political community. And Augustine never thinks that, and medievals don't think that, right? Charlemagne doesn't think that the Holy Roman Empire is some imprint of the heavenly city. He thinks it's going to be better for everybody because it's better for him as a king to receive by grace the powers that he also has by nature, right? As a king, that's better. That's more in accord with reality. That's more in accord with the tranquility of order that's going to be better for people. So, but never, never in a moment does he ever think, oh, I'm building the city of God on earth. He thinks I'm ordering the common goods rightly, according to reality, yes.
I mean, to follow up on that, I mean, it does seem very important thinking about the history of the way different political theologies developed, that the Islamic world, for instance, never had someone like Augustine to make this kind of distinction and say...
Couldn't.
Right, because the building and propagation of the Ummah on earth is the work of God on earth.
Yes.
And these Augustinian splits,
yeah.
Or at least the distinction between the city of God and any
yeah.
earthly polity does matter.
Yeah.
And makes the development of the political tradition quite different. Mm. And in that sense, you could maybe read Augustine as a proto-liberal, even though it's a huge stretch.
Yeah, in a sense, a proto-liberal, if liberal means... If liberal means what?
I guess a certain circumspection about the ethical ambitions of politics.
Okay, that's a very broad definition of liberal.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a liberal.
I mean, you can
all.
Get such broad definitions of liberal, like, yeah, I'm a liberal. Liberal's anybody who loves to exist, yes. Yes, son.
Oh, great, thanks. So I'm wondering if maybe to do the law school thing, but before an argument, I'm curious to hear your response.
For an argument from Mark?
Yeah, to try to make sense of what he's saying and maybe look at maybe a version of the objection that might be worth considering.
In deference, I don't think you normally do make a stronger argument for someone if they have taken their argument back.
Oops, yeah.
I mean, you, I'm not saying you shouldn't, but just to remind you that Marcus actually walks back a lot of his major claims, which
is it's good. But anyways, it seems like one thing in Augustine's definition that's doing a lot of work is when he talks about how the earthly city, you know, in some extent, you know, he says it's okay to be intermingled as long as, it seems like the important qualification is, as long as it doesn't, like, prevent true religion, right, religion, or true worship. So it seems like with that qualification, there does seem to, I mean, depending on how you interpret that, like, is liberal society preventing true religion? And I think there's lots of good arguments to say that to some degree it is. But I think you might also be able to make the argument, so that might be where the real difference goes, where, you know, to some extent maybe, you know, liberal society or liberal orders is enabling true religion by giving people more religious freedom. So that maybe that's where it's...
Let's put the strong argument for the classical liberal position,
yeah.
Right? Let's say the classical liberal says, okay, well, Augustine says that you can have a compromise of wills so long as it isn't an impediment to true religion and piety, right? And the classical liberal could say, well, look at Brownson, or look at what the bishops in the 19th century saw in America. They saw that none of this was contrary to true religion and piety, and therefore the liberal order is not in a contradiction, right? So that would be a strong argument. So there you could say, okay, well, maybe there's a kind of classical liberal version of Marcus's argument, which says not that Augustine is the progenitor of this, but that it's not contrary to what Augustine would accept, and that maybe the classical liberal defense of liberal order would actually fit somewhere further up the metaphysical scale, because at least in that order there's a recognition of God, and you could argue, I don't think this is true, but you could argue that the freedom of the church is unimpeded.
Well, it was interesting because at the session with Justice Alito...
That's the kind of strong argument that you
were
looking for, yeah.
Yeah,
I think that's probably the strongest argument that one can make.
Yeah, it seemed like, you know...
And fits with his revisions, too.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like one thing I was struck with Justice Alito's comments was, you know, I was asking about religious pluralism and whether that's a value and whether that kind of was at odds with St. Augustine's definition of the Commonwealth. And, He definitely like affirmed that, you know, religious pluralism is a good thing for America, and so that's why it seems like it's like that sort of an argument that is in favor of, like, the Marxist reading of Augustine. You know, it's like there is a value of religious freedom. How do we make sense of this in the Augustinian framework? So I don't know, what is your take on that? Would you say that there isn't a value of religious pluralism, or that there's no such thing as being neutral amongst religions. You're automatically, you know,
you're automatically
favoring some sort of highest good.
Yeah, it's like the Bob Dylan approach. You know,
yes.
Gonna worship somebody.
Could I just
and,
jump in?
Yes, yes. Go ahead.
Comment, because that's exactly the thing that I was thinking about too, and I guess I'm thinking about two things as well. One of them being, what are the components of, be it the city, the state, or the commonwealth? And it's the people, right? And then Augustine says that it's sort of like by the power of the Holy Spirit, that the blood of the martyrs sort of like lifts the city up towards the city.
That's
of
a beautiful way to,
like,
put it, yeah.
Yes. And so it's like, well, the power of the Holy Spirit, the grace of God really acts on the people themselves and orders their laws, but it doesn't act on, like, the state. Like,
no, which is
the
why the state is really not a category in progress.
Right.
I mean, and at
it's,
one point
but
he
it
says...
it seems to be for markets.
Yeah, absolutely. We're
so,
all liberals.
Yes, so I think that thinking about people as opposed to, like, maybe units might be helpful in discerning, I mean, in ordering these questions about, like, religious liberty versus, like, city of God.
I think this is very helpful because Augustine says explicitly at one point, and I should have put it on a page for you somewhere, that the Commonwealth is nothing but people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality there.
Right, that was my understanding.
That's the reality. And you can codify the relations, and then you start to get administrative state. But that the Augustinian intention is also a Platonic one, which is to relate the soul and the city, the cosmos, and bring things into their right order for flourishing, but also to recognize that they won't always be brought into right order, and you're going to get conflict and disorder, and you need to have the transcendent standard to be able to judge that and know which way you're going. Otherwise, in a positivistic frame, you don't know which way's up. Right? And so he breaks that positivistic frame, and now you know which way is up, and you know which way is down, and we're like 7 minutes over, and there's a lot of hands up. So I think in deference to our schedule, I will stop, but I will can answer a lot of questions if you bring them up to me privately during coffee. So thank you very much.